All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Tuesday, October 31st, 2017. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Tuesday, everyone. It is a chilly 42 degrees, overcast, and about ready to rain here again in upstate New York. So where did we leave off yesterday? We titled the show Smart Cities, Surveillance, Smart Dust, Swarms, Internet of Things, and Smart Globe. And we took a look again over the last few days at some of the stuff that is coming with these smart cities and some of the things they are doing in Saudi Arabia with their new NEOM, built by robots for robots and innovation. They want to become a tech hub in the Middle East. And some of the ways that the smart dust technology miniaturizing electronics might help that come to pass by being able to sense the environment, and not just in the outside world and with all of our mini devices, but also inside of our bodies, to be able to monitor real time, which is what the key is. Well, today we have a very special surprise for everyone. We have a special guest, Ira Pastor, who is the Chief Executive Officer of BioQuark, Inc. BioQuark has been working on regenerative medicine and being able to set the clock back for chronic degenerative diseases and try to bring back youth. Ira has over 30 years of experience across multiple sectors of the pharmaceutical industry, including pharmaceutical commercialization, biotech drug development, managed care, distribution, OTC, and retail. He has served as the VP of business development for drug development companies Phytometrics and raised over $40 million of private equity, consummating over $50 million worth of licensing deals and bringing lead drug candidates from the discovery stage to phase three development. Prior to that, he was employed by SmithKline Beecham Pharmaceuticals, working in sales, marketing, and business strategy positions. And Mr. Pastor has also served as vice president of corporate development for the pharmacy benefit management company Prescription Delivery System, and has an MBA from Temple University and a BS in pharmacy from Rutgers University. He is also a board member of the Regenerage SAPI, and a clinical company focused on expedited translational therapeutic applications of regenerative and rejuvenative healthcare interventions, as well as the Reanima Project. We've talked about that before. And he is a member of the Executive Council of the World Academy of Medical Sciences, as well as a member of the World Economic Forum's Human Enhancement Council. Now, BioQuark is focused on the development of novel biologics and that have the ability to naturally modify the regulatory state of human tissues and organs. We've talked a lot about longevity medicine and rejuvenation in the past, with the goal of curing a range of chronic degenerative diseases as well as effecting complex regeneration. Now, if you give me just one second here, you know I don't do this too often. Let me get Ira on the line. Ira.
Hey.
Good morning. This is Jules. How are you?
Great, Jules. How are you?
Good. We just did an introduction as to your history and read the statement on your website about BioQuark and what they actually do, creating biologics. Now, can you tell us a little bit about biologics and how they differ from traditional medications?
Absolutely. So from a sort of a strict regulatory definition, you know, biologics are defined as any sort of bioproduct or biologically active substance derived from a living cell system. So if you think of all the stuff that we synthesize chemically in the lab, or what more traditionally are thought of as drugs in those little pills that you take, whether that be aspirin or Tylenol, what have you, those are chemical drugs, while biologics are things that were made, either a protein from a cell, or say a vaccine, or even a living cell product. So these all are fall within the basket of biologics and biopharmaceutical materials that are used for human health.
And for these biologics, one of the things that your company is investing in is trying to turn back the clocks of time. That's pretty interesting, considering I am getting close to my 50s now, and I'm already starting to suffer from some of the degeneration of aging. What exactly are in biologics? You said that they're derived from cells, but is this some sort of cell therapy or immunotherapy? How exactly do biologics work?
Okay, I will give you the background to that. So, you know, we got our start here sort of looking at the natural world and all the organisms out there that sort of from a health and wellness perspective are much further advanced than we are. So, you know, undoubtedly your audience is well aware that many members of the amphibian kingdom are capable of replacing lost or damaged organs and tissues in perfect structure and function continually throughout our lives, whether that's the spinal cord or limbs or even parts of their hearts and segments of their brains. When anything like that happens to us, it's gone forever, and we have a very poor regenerative skill. Similarly, many of these species in nature are very good at correcting damage when it happens. So I always give the example that, you know, cancer is something that everything in the biologic kingdom gets. Humans get cancer, dogs get cancer, snakes, frogs, fish, trees. But how lower organisms deal with it is decidedly different than humans. They just like to shrug it off and turn cancer and tumors back into normal tissues. And so it very infrequently kills them. And what we discovered early on in our process was that a lot of these wonderful capabilities in the natural world go back to this underlying ability for that species to take that cell or that tissue and turn it back in time to when it wasn't older, when it wasn't damaged, when it wasn't degenerating, sort of a biologic clock rewind. So we got to thinking, you know, how could we take this capability and sort of reignite it in humans? And where we look, and we spent most of our research, is in eggs or ooplasm, the material that normally is responsible for turning back time. You know, when every baby on this planet is born, they're not born age 30 with the chronic degenerative diseases of older age, but they're born age zero. So there is this intrinsic capability in nature to turn back time. So we study ooplasm and all of the biologic materials within that that are responsible for turning back time early in life, and focusing on how we can create biologic drugs that can do the same thing, but in all of our tissues. And so this is sort of the nature of our program. We're using living systems, so eggs, and learning how to purify and isolate certain substances, proteins, microRNAs, peptides, what have you, that are responsible for this turning back of the clock. And we feel that there's a really important basket of materials, biomaterials, biodrugs there for us to utilize in the coming decades for this purpose in humans, for both regeneration, repair, and the big R, which you mentioned, rejuvenation.
And would these be considered some sort of gene therapy? I mean, would they be actually flipping switches if you took one of these? Or would this be something that would be adding capabilities through substances coming from the organism that you're using the ooplasm from?
Exactly. Number two, the question about genetic engineering comes up a lot. And the problem there is most organisms, this is sort of one of the unspoken discoveries of the Human Genome Project. But at the end of the day, what we found out from the Human Genome Project is, you know, we had 25,000 genes, and it was very similar to most other organisms out there, whether it was dogs or rats or mice. At the end of the day, we all pretty much have the same genome. What was different, though, was the regulatory genome and sort of the stuff in between the genes and how they're expressed. So why a rat turns out a rat and why an octopus turns out an octopus and why we turn out a human. So genetic engineering didn't give us the solutions we're looking for, because a lot of the genes that, you know, for instance, are responsible for longer life also show up in cancer. It's one of the reasons cancer cells are immortal, is because they have genetic capabilities to live a very long period of time. So we got to thinking, the answer isn't found in just switching genes on via some type of gene engineering or gene editing. The answer is how we look at the regulatory genome, which controls the expression of genes in different states, and tweak it with biologic materials. So it's why, going back to as a company, we said, no, we're not going to be a gene therapy company. That would be impossible anyway, because, you know, if there's 30 genes responsible for a certain biologic trait or disease transition, we're not going to be able to do that across 100 trillion cells of our body. But basically, how we can look at this sort of reprogramming basket of peptides and apply it in specific tissues only. So, you know, if we're looking at spinal cord injury and we want to retest that tissue from scar tissue to neural tissue to get you up and out of a wheelchair, it's not going to be dumping in a ton of new genes or turning on ones that are responsible for cellular proliferation. We're not interested in uncontrolled cell growth. We're interested in controllable reprogramming and redevelopment. So getting, so the short, giving back to the long answer, the short answer is no, it's not a genetic engineering tool, but it will be based more on how we can recapitulate that dynamic with biologic moieties like peptides, proteins, microRNAs to have that effect without permanently changing or altering the genome.
So these would be more like targeted therapies at a specific bodily function you're trying to bring back, as opposed to a generalized fountain of youth.
Exactly. And ultimately, you know, if the fountain of youth follows us, that's great. But, you know, I come from the pharmaceutical industry, and, you know, the problem I've always had with the old school approach has been, you know, when we create that drug at the end of the day and it goes into your body, for the most part, you know, it's headed towards 100 trillion cells of many different regulatory states, and it's affecting them in all kinds of ways. It's not targeted at all. So ultimately, yes, I mean, whether we're regenerating heart or kidney or liver or spinal column or part of the brain, indirectly, we believe regeneration and rejuvenation of those tissues is a path towards ultimate rejuvenation and longevity. So targeted, tissue specific, but ultimately we're a system of organs and tissues, and as we repair each specific component, we are indirectly having a higher rejuvenative effect.
And would these be designed for the specific patient, such as like precision medicine based upon their genetic profile, or are there more generic regenerative capabilities that you can take advantage of just by us being human and targeting a kidney, let's say?
Yeah, I mean, this is not like an immunotherapy. So no, we don't have to spend millions of dollars to try to target this toward a specific gene mutation in a specific patient. Ultimately, what we're coming at this from a slightly different angle. We're basically starting with the perspective that, look, in your body right now, as we have this conversation, you and I are doing all sorts of things behind the scenes. We're sitting here right now in the next hour, we're fighting cancer very quietly. Small transitions happen across those 100 trillion cells thousands of times a day in our body, and our body, via what are known as cellular competition mechanisms, corrects them. And for the most part, for the first several decades of our lives, does it very well. So we are not interested in targeting towards all 100 trillion cells, and we're not interested in targeting towards a specific mutation, but we're specifically interested in those tissues where the transition is going wrong. And that is where we find our materials is targeted the best, where you may have good tissue and transformation tissue, in the case of cancer, where that cellular competition dynamic is happening, and that's where we can interfere and quickly turn back the clock, specifically in those tissues. We don't want to turn back the clock in all tissues in the area. We want to recapitulate that particular situation, which allows state B to go back to state A, specifically targeted in that context.
And what exact organ systems are you targeting? You mentioned the spinal column. I read on your website you were targeting trying to bring back kidneys. We had read back last year about some of the brain rejuvenation. Mm-hmm. Have you looked at anything like arterial sclerosis or rheumatoid arthritis or bone degeneration?
We have, CNS is a big part of our program just because it is such a, as our pharmaceutical industry has an unmet medical need of immense proportion, especially with sort of the silver tsunami of Alzheimer's and so forth that is coming our way. So everything from the higher central nervous system to the spinal column is in our list of targets. We're very active in spinal cord regeneration dynamics. We are very interested in the higher brain, not just from the chronic degenerative diseases, your Alzheimer's, your Parkinson's disease, but also traumatic brain injury. And we are also, as mentioned, interested in the kidney. And this may be sound a little odd because we have two kidneys and kidney transplantation is a big thing. But at the end of the day, kidney transplantation and dialysis represent about $60 billion a year, yearly. If we can ultimately induce endogenous repair and regeneration in the kidney and keep patients from having to go down those paths, which while they work in the sense dialysis and transplants do their thing, ultimately yields a much lower quality of life than if we could just repair the damaged tissue. So that's very exciting to us. In terms of autoimmune diseases, we've done less there to date, but we have begun some models in specifically in the area of psoriasis and lupus. And it is interesting to us because I have in previous my previous career have been involved in the autoimmune space, specifically from the area of suppressing the immune system, which is not an overly exciting set of mechanisms. But if we can not only repair and regenerate the tissue that is being destroyed via the autoimmune mechanism, but also get to the core of why it is happening. And this is one of the sort of the holy grail areas that, obviously the inflammation and tissue damage is an important target, but there is stuff happening upstream, whether that is viral or genetically inherited. But if we can shut down those mechanisms as well, there may be a very likely path towards curative interventions for the whole span of autoimmune disorder. So that is something we are quite interested in and is definitely part of our list of targets moving forward.
Yeah, that's a huge market. I know a lot of people who have been diagnosed with autoimmune and they still don't know what really causes it.
Yeah. And it's one of those things, strangely enough, that when you get down those paths through the complex biologics and disease modifying agents, and patients still do not have major results, you don't think of it as one of these things where people really want to give up, like cancer. But you speak to some of these patients in the clinical setting, and it's as bad as cancer or organ degeneration. They just, it's a horrible quality of life, and many of them just give up after a while. So it is, needless to say, a very important and unmet medical need as well.
It is. Now, how would some of these therapies be administered? Would this be done, do you imagine, through an injection or a pill or some sort of hospital setting with an IV or surgery?
Yeah, I mean, everything that we're doing is based on the current biologic model of drug development. So most administration would be parenteral, whether that is subcutaneous or intramuscular or some type of systemic administration of that nature. Because we deal with proteins and peptides, we probably are not going to have oral delivery systems in place because of the issue of getting bioactive proteins through the gut. However, nonetheless, these are not going to be extremely complex therapeutics like some of the other things that are coming down the path in terms of gene editing and cell therapies and what have you. So people are always asking, is this only going to be for rich people? And we say absolutely not, because everything we're using is off-the-shelf biologic production 101 that the pharmaceutical industry has had in place for the last 50 years. So these, we foresee everything coming out of our pipeline ultimately as being completely in line with any other biologic product that's been on the market for years now.
Now, are you affiliated with any hospitals or universities that you've been working with on some of your discoveries?
We were originally spun out of University of South Florida, of the Tampa campus, based on some original reprogramming technology from about 10 years ago, which sort of got the company started. We've done some work on our microRNA and protein analysis with Duke. We have some collaborative work here in Philadelphia at University of Pennsylvania, studying some of the immune system components in terms of immunogenicity and allergenicity when it comes to the development of therapeutic peptides. But ultimately, we are an independent company that is not affiliated with any university currently beyond on a contract basis.
And have you been able to take advantage of any of the 21st Century Cures Act's acceleration of therapy approval from the FDA?
Not yet. We haven't specifically, from a regulatory angle, gone down that path in the U.S. I mean, we're a big supporter of compassionate use and compassionate access. We've taken the perspective that, from a global angle, that although we are a U.S. company and we're based in the U.S., there are 200 other countries out there. And as important as the U.S. market is to us, if you are in this day and age ignoring what we used to refer to in the pharmaceutical industry as sort of rest of world, you're doing yourself a big disservice, because even though the U.S. is 40-some-odd% of the global pharmaceutical spend, most of the smart people will tell you that in the coming 10, 20 years, you're going to see a much bigger uptake from the BRICS plus 20 other developing nations. And unless you're active in some of these places, you're going to miss the bus. So, we follow the legislative and regulatory initiatives that occur here, but we also keep our eye out for what else is going on and what other countries are doing. We like to point to the recent relationship between the government of China and the fifth largest drug company in the world, Merck, that is has done a sort of a blanket compassionate use program with one of their antibodies, Keytruda, for cancer. But we think there are a lot of innovative models in this era that drug companies and biotech companies need to be aware of, because the sort of the old school model doesn't work for most people, especially when it comes to degenerative diseases that make us suffer and make us die.
Right. Now, has DARPA shown any interest in some of the projects you're working on? I've covered them a lot, and they seem to be pretty interested in traumatic brain injury cures and spinal column and the ability to walk after some sort of traumatic injury, with lots of different financing.
Yeah, I mean, we keep our eye always on the government programs, whether that be DARPA or other aspects of the military, or whether it just be some of the NIH units in terms of specific diseases. It's a very interesting path, and as you're undoubtedly aware, there is billions of dollars that are there and left on the table every year as well. It's just a matter of the of going through that system. And in my previous company, we had an entire team that was involved in writing grants and waiting on the results, and when they're rejected, rewriting them, and ultimately accessing those forms of funds. We're a smaller company, and so we do not have the luxury always of putting a small team together that can focus specifically on those initiatives, but we do keep our eye on them, especially as it pertains to traumatic damage, spinal injury, and you know, also a lot of the stuff that's going on with NASA in terms of zero gravity impact on the human body, radiation resistance, things of this form. So we are aware of them, and you know, hopefully we'll take advantage of more of them in the future as we grow.
Now, you just mentioned radiation resistance. I was reading, I think it might have been a story that you posted yesterday or the day before on one of your feeds in regards to different regeneration that occurs in the animal kingdom. And there was a section that talked about a bacteria that was fully radiation resistant. Is that something, in looking at biologics, would you be looking at the genetics of that bacteria to maybe figure out how you could implement something like that in a human?
Yeah, that's Deinococcus radiodurans. It's listed as, you know, the toughest thing on earth to kill, because it's one of the only organisms that I'm aware of that dies and comes back to life via a phoenix-like DNA repair system. And it's, you know, it's listed as a, you know, so-called polyextremophile. So I think it swims around in nuclear radiation and has a happy day and does its thing. Absolutely. We have studied the literature in terms of Deinococcus and its abilities, and DNA repair is an important part of the overall aging, genetic damage, chromosomal damage set of diseases. So, you know, we are very interested in such organisms. We're also interested in ones that are technically biologically immortal. So things like the immortal jellyfish, Turritopsis, which is not very tough, but it is very good at deciding, you know, growing up and deciding later on in life to become a kid again and turn itself back into its polyp phase and start life over. So we are very interested in those reprogramming dynamics and have modeled some of our development program based on those. And then, you know, sort of a third subset of that, which are also interesting creatures to that effect, are these tardigrades, which, you know, form a unique little class of, not technically insects, although, you know, they don't really fall any other segment of the tree of life. But these folks, they don't live very long, but they go into this state of cryptobiosis where they basically fall asleep for a couple thousand years and wake up and go about their day. So we think there is a lot of important things to learn from the all facets of the biologic kingdom, especially these outliers, which are so good at surviving and staying alive.
Now, how long would you hope that one of these therapies would be effective before degeneration would set in again? So let's say somebody, you know, goes through and has a kidney regenerated. Would they then be set back to the stage of being a child and have an entire lifetime of damage they could perform again?
Ideally, that's ultimately the ability to reset a cell. It is a multifunctional event, but we study it. So, you know, it's not just a function of, hey, we're repairing these genes and starting the function over again. We are potentially elongating telomeres for creating a more youthful cell. We are remodeling organelles to be more youthful. And then we're also taking into account a lot of the infectious, oxidative, and inflammatory insults that go along throughout a lifetime of the cell's existence. So, yes, ultimately that is the goal, that if you have lived a life and kidney damage creeps up on you in your mid-50s, we'd like to give you kidneys back at the end of the day that are that of a child, fresh, functional, and doing the job for you. That is the ideal. And so we see no reason that's not in our set of capabilities in the coming years.
Do you have any clinical trials scheduled in the near future?
Yeah, I mean, we have begun some ex-US work with partners in India, South Africa, and Thailand. So we're beginning to generate some early sort of phase one, phase two exploratory work. Our U.S. clinical program is probably not going to come online until for about 3 more years. But nonetheless, as mentioned, there's other systems out there, and to partner with other clinical groups is part of our strategy. And if we can get to the clinic two years faster elsewhere, it's great for us to help bring together the basket of data, because every specific use and piece of human experience helps. Animal models are great, but at the end of the day, human models are what means anything. And so we are slowly but surely moving in those directions. We also doing some clinical work in terms of our non-Rx business, in terms of the topical uses of these types of products in non-Rx cosmetic and dermatological products, which has also been quite exciting. So we are taking advantage of all pathways that are available to us, both drug and non-drug, to further advance these materials.
Now, would there be any intellectual property claims to, say, a regenerated kidney? Like, let's say if a Chinese firm offered a patient $100,000 for a biopsy so they could reverse engineer the technologies you used. You know, have you ever thought about anything like that?
You know, we sit in a really unique area. And so, we describe what we do as combinatory biologic. So let me explain what that means. Traditionally, you can think of most drugs as having a single use, single drug entity. It is, whether that's that molecule of aspirin or that Viagra or whatever. In the past, and in certain cases now, drugs take on other forms, and they may have more than one entity. Why would we do this? Well, most complex events in nature are not going to be solved with a single magic bullet. It's just not the way nature works. And so when you develop a substance that has more than one entity to it, things get quite complex. And so while the generic companies or groups in China may find it quite easy to copy that Viagra or that aspirin compound, when you get into the mix of complex biologic materials, it becomes an impossibility. And so, one case in point is an example we like to give. I ask, what do people think the most prescribed drug in history is? And they'll throw things out there, like Viagra, like Lipitor, what have you. But no, the most prescribed drug on a pill by pill basis ever in history is Pfizer's Premarin, a mixture of estrogen compounds derived from the urine of horses, pregnant horses, that has been on the market since the early 1940s, and it has never been copied because you can never copy a mixture. So we find ourselves in a rather unique situation whereby, although there are aspects of nature that you cannot patent, you can patent processes, you can patent specific clinical uses, and you can build yourself a very nice intellectual protection around something that is so complex that generic companies just at the end of the day walk away.
Now, have you received any type of interest from the technology companies? I remember a few years back there was a story that came out of Washington Post about Tech Titan's latest project is to defy death, and they were investing in all kinds of technologies that would set the clock back. And even Peter Thiel was working on parabiosis project utilizing proteins from young blood to turn the clock back in older biological organisms. I would imagine that some of the things that you're working on would probably garner some interest.
Yeah, I mean, we do as, you know, even though we are a regenerative medicine company, we do sort of cross over into the realm of longevity enhancement and anti-aging, and definitely run into it at meetings and scientific conferences, many of these folks. And I think it's great that, you know, the Silicon Valley crew is taking an interest in this space. They definitely have the money and the wherewithal. But at the end of the day, as much money as a Google may have, drug development is still an expensive long-term project, unlike, you know, new apps. And you know, all you have to realize is that the combined expenditure of the top pharmaceutical companies every year is $200 billion, and I don't know if that's something that a company, some of these tech companies, really appreciate and are going to spend the long-term money on. And some of the projects I scratch my head about, they're more early stage stuff, or they're sort of longevity light. I mean, parabiosis is something that strategically from Aringo, we do not agree with or take a part in, primarily because the history of basically putting young stuff of any type into an older body doesn't work. And usually when you look at the historical research, it's usually the reverse, where a younger microenvironment or a younger tissue system that gets an old cell converts the old cell back to young. And so that's why we have sort of steered away from this concept of, you know, vampire young blood theories, and have more focused on, look, how do we turn back the entire system as opposed to just dump some younger cells into it? And we think our strategy is probably more on the mark. But we'll see in the long term.
So speaking of bringing things back, when last year your Reanima project kind of hit the news, and I covered that quite extensively because I've always been interested in the brain and how a lot of these universities and scientists are working on mapping all the neurons so they could use it for recreating artificial intelligence. But how is that experiment going? I saw now that it's been rescheduled for South America or somewhere down in the Southern Hemisphere.
We are coming online in South America. We're taking a unique path in terms of this legal system that is available in Latin American countries called Recurso de Amparo. So that we will be announcing shortly. But, you know, India is still online. They, you know, although we had some interjection from the Indian Council of Medical Research, they don't have regulatory oversight there. The Central Drug Standard Control Organization does. So a project of this nature always get people a little jumpy. But at the end of the day, we are slowly but surely progressing with our strategies there. And we feel that it is an area of research in terms of the so-called severe disorders of consciousness that, you know, has gotten no interest over the last 50-some-odd and needs some attention. Because at the end of the day, the reason 65 million of us leave this world every year is because our brain dies. And with everything we are learning in the realm of neural regeneration and complex tissue formation, this is something that we just cannot, as a group, overlook. Combine that with the fact that living cadaver research has gone on for decades now behind the scenes, using human cadavers or that have been donated to science for studying, you know, complex pharmaco and pharmacological dynamics. And on top of that, you know, we have, although they don't like to talk about it, but you have, if you go into the literature, since the 1968 Harvard irreversibility definition of brain death or irreversible coma, you will find several dozen cases that sort of get swept under the rug as far as people that have been diagnosed, primarily young subjects, but where brain death reversal technically occurred. Now, in many of those cases, there were poor prognoses, they're controversial, but at the end of the day, they highlight that when it comes to death, things are not always black and white. And we, in the year 2017, we need to look back at the definitions created in 1968 and say to ourselves, well, maybe we should have a second look at this, especially with the knowledge base we have today and the technology base. So this is still a crucial part of our program, and we think it's a viable form of research, especially when it comes to the trickle-down effect on all diseases of the central nervous system.
That's true. Now, for that project, were you using, I remember reading it was a combination of stem cells and some sort of electrical or laser stimulation of the central nervous system?
Yeah, in that particular case, so we went a step beyond in crafting that protocol, what we are doing with other diseases, but, you know, we looked at epimorphic regeneration as it occurs in the brain of non-human organisms. And so this may be surprising to many of your audience, but there are organisms like certain salamanders and planarian worms that whose brains you can slice right out and they grow a new brain. And we were studying for several years how this happens. And it is a complex process, and it's not, as I mentioned before, it's not a single mechanism. It is involved in a mechanism of reprogramming the tissue that remains of the central nervous system. There is a histolytic response to clear away dead tissue. There is an activation of the innate immune response. A lot of stuff is going on. So we wanted to create a protocol that could mimic that. So yes, it involves our regenerative biologics, it involves stem cells, and also several of the tools that are currently used in the intensive care unit nowadays, such as median nerve stimulation, transcranial IV laser, and so forth, which are used in coma patients currently in ICUs all around the world as a way to potentially stimulate them and wake them or move them up the continuum. So that was a concept, and we feel that it makes a lot of sense, not just the ability to stimulate some nerve growth, but ultimately how you craft entirely new tissue and guide its formation in the appropriate way. And that is the core nature to the protocol. And, you know, it's a work in progress, and I'm sure, you know, we're always getting contacted about other things that could potentially be applied and utilized in a protocol of this nature because it is so new and unique. But you know, we're confident, and we're very happy with the program as it's progressing.
Now, as far as informed consent goes, would that be something that the family would make the decision?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It has to be a family decision. We do not have a model to date, like, say, the cryonics industry, whereby somebody can sign up for this to happen 20 years in the future or what have you. But, yeah, so there is a rather complex family-centric informed consent that we go through. And, you know, we're totally transparent here with, you know, what this project is, what it's not. Obviously, there was a lot of hype, a lot of zombie hype and so forth, but it is a little less dramatic than the press likes to portray it.
Now, would you use yourself as a human test subject for some of these technologies? I know a while back there were a few stories that came out. One was a CEO who tested a genetic therapy on herself, and I think it was for telomere lengthening. And another one was a Russian scientist who had found this 3.5 million year old bacteria, and he injected himself to see if it would make him younger. I mean, I'm not saying like outside of the FDA, but let's say some of these were approved. Would this be something that you yourself would feel comfortable with if you were in a hospital bed? Because, I mean, despite how we feel about these technologies, I've always said that at some point in the future, we're all going to be faced with, you know, this weight where we might have a choice or might not have a choice, depending on how we feel ethically.
Absolutely. I would not hesitate. And self-experimentation is something I'm very familiar with both cases that you mentioned. I know those both people. And yes, I think it's a, you know, looking back, especially the last few decades of medical research, going back to the H. pylori discovery and peptic ulcers from back in the 1980s and so forth. Self-experimentation has, you know, been a major evolutionary step in many cases to our scientific understanding. So definitely, once again, depending on the regulatory situation, depending on the model, I feel there is always room for it. And especially when it comes to a comfort level that we are working specifically with biologic materials that the genome or our genome knows, that has seen, remember, you know, we, as unique as our human genome is, you know, it didn't fall out of the sky. It is an iteration of a genome from millions of years ago. So, you know, that is why until this very day, you know, 85%+ of all drugs that are on the market still today have their origins from nature, whether that be plants or fungi or bacteria. So I would not hesitate for a second, based on our program. Would I genetically engineer myself nowadays? Absolutely not. And this is not as much from a safety perspective as it is that we're just not big fans of genetic engineering. And there's a lovely line that Craig Venter loves to say in some of his presentations, you know, we are not giant amoebas. If we were, it would make genetic engineering pretty easy. But you and I are made up of 100 trillion cells, and the technology is just not there to do it right across 100 trillion cells today. So I would never genetic engineer myself today, or probably in the next couple decades. But when it comes down to biologics and other materials that are much closer to what our genomes understand and what our genomes have seen, I have no problem with that.
And what does your family think about what you do? I'm sure, I mean, I've been to so many family events and try to explain what I spent my last 30 years in technology, and it's kind of like the deer in the headlights look, you know. Do they understand the ramifications of the future of healthcare to what you are doing? And
absolutely. They understand it pretty well. I mean, a few years ago, you know, they'd go into school and daddy's going to make you live forever. But more recently, it's been, you know, I was called in to give a lecture to a biology class just about some of these concepts that we don't think about. Some of what we mentioned, you know, I was a big fan of science fiction and comic books growing up, and you think about Spider-Man and suspended animation in the movie Alien and so forth. But I say, hey, look, I mean, here we are, 2017, and we have technologies. We're trying to spin spider silk for super strong fabrics to use in surgery. We are studying cryptobiosis as ways to go into a state of suspended animation for surgical purposes. And even here in Philadelphia, we have a group at Temple University working on liquid breathing and basically how one can figure out why it's so easy for us for the first 9 months to breathe liquid inside the womb, and how we can translate that technology out into the real world for to take care of premature babies. So I think they get it, and they're very interested. I don't think – I have three children. I don't think any of them yet have made the decision to go into the biomedical field. They're 15, 13, and 11. They're more interested in space and mechanical engineering and things of that nature, but who knows, maybe I'll convert them at some point.
Now, are you utilizing any type of artificial intelligence on the back end to help you develop some of these biologics?
None beyond just the tools of proteomics, the microRNA screening and things of this nature. You know, I can't speak too much about artificial intelligence, but I can say that nature does a pretty good job. Evolution has done a pretty good job of figuring this stuff out. And I think Great. I mean, if we can create computer programs that more efficiently allow us to, target or craft molecules in the future, that's all wonderful stuff. I point out at the end of the day, the big cost and the time in drug development is still clinical trials, and I don't think artificial intelligence is ever going to get rid of that. I think it has its place. I don't know if it's going to eliminate the need to have the sort of the human factor that is involved in the bench to clinic development process as it's stood today for a long period of time.
Now, you mentioned Craig Venter. Are you utilizing any type of synthetic DNA or RNA, or is this all animal derived?
No, it's all nature derived. We feel that, look, at the end of the day, evolution has done a pretty decent job. Nature shows us quite clearly, if we take time to look for the clues, what works and what doesn't. And the stuff that doesn't work isn't here anymore, and the stuff that does work, we can learn from. And there's a reason that, these trees outside my window here have survived for billions of years, even though there have been multiple extinctions and ice ages and infections and what have you. I feel the answer is to not always look at the most high-tech stuff in the future, but look back at what has come before and figure out what we can learn from it.
So what are your thoughts on the sequencing of the human genome and then trying to come up with a synthetic human genome?
I think the sequencing of the human genome was a wonderful thing. It highlighted, it told everybody, look, we have 25,000 protein coding genes. What it didn't express as much at the beginning was that we're not much different from most other species that are out there. We're not too unique. As important as those 25,000 protein coding genes are, they represented only about a startling 1% of the genomic space. What we initially 20 years ago said, that 99% is junk. No, it's turning out it's not junk. And it's turning out that the architecture of the genome and the hierarchy that controls that architecture, whether that's gene regulatory networks, cellular regulatory networks, the biodynamics of this human system, it's all part of an architecture. And by itself, the genome does nothing. It's just information. How we access it and how we utilize it is distinctly more important. So it's a very important set of data, but I think equally important would be studying this sort of area of evolutionary genomics and understanding that, a lot of the stuff that kills us on a daily basis benefits other species. and having an understanding of, those high blood sugar levels, which are seen in diabetes and endocrine dysfunction in humans, but they're required by all fast-sprinting organisms. Inflammation, which manifests in a bunch of different ways in terms of inflammatory and allergic responses, is many species' only form of infectious disease response on this planet. So I think not only studying the human genome, but understanding the genomes that come before us and the different architectures and why one thing that is so beneficial couple million years ago ends up killing us is an equally important area of comparative genomics, as it's called, to really understand moving forward.
Now, speaking about things that are killing us, let's talk about cancer for a minute. What types of cancers were you targeting? I did see melanoma listed.
We've been studying a variety of different types of systems, melanoma, glioma, breast cancer, but it basically all falls into the same basket. That our strategy is a little different. So since the beginning of the war on cancer. We've taken a kill-centric mentality that basically the only drivers of cancer are these somatic mutations, and that tumors are clonal, they're homogeneous, and they're very easy to target with sort of these traditional tools of surgery, radiation, chemotherapy, or the targeted smart drugs. The problem has been that there are many things, there's many cases that these somatic mutation theory of cancer do not deal with. And there is a sort of a growing set of thought leaders in this field that say, wait a second, we have seen the past whereby, you know, we use a shotgun approach with chemotherapy and we blast stuff away, and yet there is tumor recovery. We also see that with some of these smart immunotherapies now, they do a great job of melting tumors away, but in five people. And the rest of the people, the stuff doesn't work. What are we missing? And I think one of the things we're missing is what we're beginning to learn, or what the systems biology folks are beginning to see, is that A, mutations may not be causative of cancer at all, but they may be only permissive of it. And B, more importantly, is tumors are baskets of cells with many different regulatory states. And you can have the best immunotherapy and targeted drug ever, but if you're only killing 10% of that tumor off and leaving 90% behind to ravage you and destroy you, it's the wrong approach. And so once again, we're going back to nature. We're saying, wait a second. We have all these organisms out there that get cancer that don't focus on a kill-centric response. They focus on a reprogramming response, taking that lung cancer and turning it back into normal lung tissue. And maybe there's another approach out there as opposed to just finding a new kill mechanism that gives us two extra months of life and really doing something different. And that is our core strategy. And we've seen some exciting results so far in the lab, in the petri dish, in animal models of various types. And this is a very exciting part of our program. And, you know, regeneration and cancer have always been part of a double-edged sword, going back 100 years now in biologic research. One is opposite of the other, uncontrollable regeneration versus no regeneration.
Oh, and thank you very much. That is the end of the show. Ira Pastor of BioQuark.com. Thank you very much for the interview.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
My name is